opinion. The work it has on hand and the end it keeps in view are too absorbing and too lofty to leave it the time or inclination to take part in side issues. That work and that end is the dissemination of the fundamental principles of the philosophy of theosophy and the exemplification in practice of those principles through a truer realization of the self, a profounder conviction of universal brotherhood. It holds that the unassailable basis for union among theosophists, wherever and however situated, is similarity of aim, purpose, and teaching, and therefore has neither constitution, bylaws, nor officers, the sole bond between its associates being that basis, and it aims to disseminate this idea among theosophists in the furtherance of unity. It regards as theosophists all who are engaged in the true service of humanity without distinction of race, creed, sex, condition, or organization, and it welcomes to its association all those who are in accord with its declared purposes and who desire to fit themselves by study and otherwise to be the better able to help and teach others. The true theosophist belongs to no cult or sect, yet belongs to each and all. In order to live up to this declaration, here in Philadelphia, we have two weekly meetings. On Wednesdays, we open at 5:15, and until 7:15, there is a reference library. Then at 7:30, we have a study class that lasts till 8:30. We are currently studying the Ocean of Theosophy on the subject of the human constitution, the mind. On Sunday mornings, we open at 10:30 and have this meeting from 11 to 12, where a short talk or a lecture or a panel is given on a particular aspect of the philosophy. For the month of January, the major title is Keys to Spiritual Growth. And next Sunday, the 10th, we have Where and How to Find Truth. The work done at this lodge, anywhere in the world, is done on a voluntary basis of time, of service, and of money. And of course, it does take money to keep this work going, to keep the building open. There is a reading chosen for this morning from the Voice of the Silence. Behold it written, ere the gold flame can burn with steady light, the lamp must stand well guarded in a spot free from all wind. Exposed to shifting breeze, the jet will flicker, and the quivering flame casts shades deceptive, dark, and ever-changing on the soul's white shrine. And then, O thou pursuer of the truth, thy mind soul will become as a mad elephant that rages in the jungle. Mistaking forest trees for living foes, he perishes in his attempts to kill the ever-shifting shadows dancing on the wall of sunlit rocks. Beware, lest in the care of self, thy soul should lose her foothold on the soul of Deva knowledge. Beware, lest in forgetting self, thy soul lose o'er its trembling mind control, and forfeit thus the due fruition of its conquests. Beware of change, for change is thy great foe. This change will fight thee off and throw thee back out of the path thou treadest, deep into viscous swamps of doubt. Prepare and be forewarned in time. If thou hast tried and failed, O dauntless fighter, yet lose not courage. Fight on, and to the charge return again and yet again. The fearless warrior, his precious lifeblood oozing from his wide and gaping wounds, will still attack the foe. Drive him from out his stronghold, vanquish him ere he himself expires. Act then, all ye who fail and suffer, act like him, and from the stronghold of your soul, chase all your foes away, ambition, anger, hatred, e'en to the shadow of desire, when even you have failed. Remember, thou that fightest for man's liberation, each failure is success, and each sincere attempt wins its reward in time. The holy germs that sprout and grow unseen in the disciple's soul, their stalks wax strong at each new trial. They bend like reeds but never break, nor can they ever be lost. But when the hour has struck, they blossom forth. The title for this morning is Real Knowledge and Those Who Know.
Good morning, and again, before we get into real knowledge, what real knowledge is, we're going to talk about those who know. Just like the Ocean of Theosophy starts out, chapter one, with the masters, and evolution begins from above, and then it winds its way down, and then it works its way back up in each and every cycle. So there's a fraternity of enlightened beings who are the custodians of all knowledge. Now, these are men like us in many ways, except that they have realized their full potential. They have perfected themselves in prior periods of evolution, and they come back because, just like we learn from them and we learn in Theosophy, it's not about us. It's not about them. They've already done it. They're here because they're working behind the scenes mainly because of their great love for all humanity and all everything that lives and breathes, the seen and the unseen. So these Mahatmas, initiates, brothers, and adepts, as they are called, their mission is to guide us and watch over us, but never to interfere, because that would be against the law and the law of karma, which is action. Of course, it's action and reaction, and it is what draws us back again and again to embodied existence in these forms that we're using to try to perfect ourselves as they have done. And they are the custodians of this knowledge, and they point the way. So they know about the great truths concerning the destiny of the soul, which they have learned by trial and error. So, working behind the scene, they at first, well, first of all, everyone who wants to tread this path, and as the reading in The Voice of the Silence, which is a great daily guide, you can't really beat it for a daily guide for meditation and aspiration. If you're serious about following the path of the masters. So the masters have worked with many movements, and they have worked with key individuals in the past, and they can even work with someone who is doing great evil, but all of a sudden they get an idea and then they do something which brings about their demise, because that's the end of their cycle. They are all over the world working behind the scenes. They can work in a body, they can work without a body, and they know each other, they all know each other in this fraternity, and they can instantly communicate with one another, time and distance being no obstacle. So we receive guidance and help, and we should try to rise to them and not expect them to come to us. We really have, well, back in 1375, there was a Tsongkhapa, gathered all the brothers, the elder brothers together, the adepts, the initiates, and decided to put forth an impulse in the last quarter of each century. So beginning in 1375, and as far as our movement goes, culminating in 1875, there was a spiritual impulse which would, for 25 years, which would carry the rest of the cycle until the following century. And but they had worked with like groups like the Masons and the Rosicrucians and secret societies. However, the time was ripe in 1875 to make it publicly known. And of course, we know the teachers, the visible teachers of H.P. Blavatsky and William Hugh Judge, but behind them, the inspiration was from the masters. And so this knowledge has been made public and available, and that is really because, 100 years before, with the Declaration of Independence and the Revolution, the Bill of Rights, that the soil was right here in the United States. We could even go back to 1675, that last quarter of the 1600s, because William Penn brought religious tolerance. There was no true religious tolerance anywhere in the world except Philadelphia. And he was very theosophical in a lot of his principles and practices. So the soil was right for physically to be safe, because physical harm was always a great danger. Mentally and spiritually. So in 1875, the work was initiated in New York, which was the largest city and the hub, the nexus, the most major nexus of all the immigration and commerce and learning. And it just, and these teachings were brought forth to try to stem the tide of materialism before it got completely out of hand. So they are the knowers and preservers of knowledge, of real knowledge, which is soul knowledge. They keep the records safe from the ravages of time and vandalism for those who would want to pervert these great ideas and use for their own selfish purposes. So they safeguard this knowledge. It's not going to disappear. It's there. But there are great cycles when there's a flowering forth, and there are declining cycles when the knowledge is diminishing and seems to disappear. But it does not disappear, because they preserve the records. So some of the powers that the Mahatmas, or great souls, command our knowledge of the mysteries of sound and color. They can direct the elemental forces, the elemental beings, which are the nerve currents of nature. And most important of all, they know what the ultimate divisions of time are and what are the meaning of the meaning of time itself and how the cycles play out. And we're told that this is the most arcane knowledge that there is. And it is not for us to know yet, but the masters know it and keep it. So there's been there are many historical proofs, really, of masters. Throughout the beginning of the theosophical, the modern public theosophical movement from 1875, masters, they corresponded with people, and they appeared in India, which is the storehouse of all this spiritual knowledge. It was, in a sense, it's the breadbasket of spiritual knowledge. And it is said that, you know, you could possibly still be some masters working publicly, but they're not open about who they are. A master would never say, "I'm a master, I'm an adept, I'm an initiate." The power that they covet and the power that a disciple should covet is to appear as nothing in the eyes of men. So it's not about the personality, it's about the message. So they provide knowledge and inspiration, and so that's on the masters. Now we want to get to what is real knowledge. So the masters, as we said, perfected themselves. But what did they perfect indeed? What is it? So we are seven principal beings. And this talk's not going to go into the four lower transitory principles which change from life to life, and they are vehicles that we use in embodied existence. But we have the three higher principles. The imperishable triad is Atma, Buddhi, and Manas. Atma being spirit, and Buddhi being a spiritual soul or the highest intuition, and also the storehouse of all the experience and knowledge of the past, and Manas. Manas being a mind principle. We are man, the word man comes from Manas, and of course that is the mind. So we're striving to make perfect Manas. In a way, the other two principles are not so much, the higher principles of Atma and Buddhi are not so much involved. They are, as Buddhi is. Spirit is without any kind of, it's unknowable. It's unknowable. We'll just leave it at that. So what are the ways we acquire knowledge? And what does the word mean? So the knowledge in the dictionary, the information given, the definition in the dictionary is, one, it is information and skills acquired through experience or education. Two, it's the sum of what is known. And three, it is awareness of familiarity of a fact. And we just wanted to, this short quote that we, when compassion is central in your life, you never work alone. So if we are truly being compassionate, we know that we are companions of the masters, because the masters need us to do the work, because the environment it's really too polluted for them to work through at this point. So direct personal experience is generally thought to be from the five senses, which are more or less operational for most of humanity. But so that's not real knowledge, though. The knowledge that we get through our senses, it does help us, it can warn us, but the real senses are located in the astral body, which is also known as linga sarira, which means design body, and it is more durable and extensible, and it has a greater tensile strength. But manas is the mind principle. It is not the brain. The brain is a wonderful, complex instrument, but it's an instrument that manas uses, that we use. So this manas principle actually is throughout nature. It is in the lower kingdoms, but it is in the lower kingdoms, it is latent or in germ form. And when manas is lit up, we talk about the lighting up of manas. It's like one candle lighting many. That happened 18 million years ago when mindless man received the gift. It's the Promethean gift of fire. So we are studying right now manas and mind in chapter 7 of the ocean. So there's a great chain of interconnectedness which man is at the crossroad of in evolution. There are those above us and those below us. We, in the reading from the voice for this morning, it talked about Deva knowledge. Well, that's the knowledge of the gods. It's the knowledge of those beings that are not flesh and blood. They work through vehicles, but we're not, you know, we can't, it's a different state, it's a different plane, so we can't cognize it. But all of the kingdoms below us, such as the animal, plant, and mineral, they are dependent upon us for their advance and evolution. So by perfecting ourselves, we are raising up all of nature, and that really is our goal. Just like the masters are selflessly working for our advance, we should in turn be selflessly working for the advance and the evolution of all nature so that they can rise up to our level at our stage, because the man stage is at the crossroads between spirit and matter. So spiritual knowledge is of loving deeds the child. It's, I believe that quote's from The Light of Asia, which is another great devotional book. So we may be initiated into greater knowledge, real knowledge, which is abstract knowledge. We need to let go of the explanation of life and nature, so given in concrete terms. We need science. We need all the discoveries of science because they help us. But if we look at it through the eyes of theosophy, and if we can learn, concentration and meditation are tools to real knowledge. We talk about them often in this room here. So the human spirit, through concentration and meditation, can actually look into the heart of nature without any mechanical aids. So that is one of the gifts which when we basically, after we go through initiations and These are not formal ceremonies. These can be daily initiations where we are gaining in knowledge and gaining in power and living the life, really living the life, and living a life of joy and emanating. There's something very attractive about being joyful and being altruistic. And so we need to learn how to emanate this. So we're going to stop here. We hope there's some seed ideas here. All is connected. Everything works in cycles. There's a mutable law which cannot be violated. We have free will. We can break the law, don't get me wrong, but we will pay the price. Maybe not in this lifetime, but when the body and circumstances are such, we will reap that karma. And it can be terrible karma, but what is pleasing to the soul is not pleasing to the personality. So we hope that you have some insights, questions, observations. Man in the back row.
The body of knowledge known as theosophy, was it ever known by any other name at another time?
Okay, the body of theosophy, the body of knowledge known as theosophy. Well, there's hidden knowledge that's been kept like in the Kabbalah, and certainly religions all start, all of the great prophets, well, none of them really started a religion per se, but they showed the way, and after they left the scene, their followers started religious practices. But what were the names? I mean, we're not sure. Do you?
Well, Plato expounded these same ideas in a very hidden way. Pythagoras as well.
Sure.
And there are, you know, Jesus did, Krishna did. There's been those that have had this knowledge, and you know, you look through history and you see personalities like Paracelsus and Saint Martin and Cagliostro. There's a whole body of individuals that express this knowledge in some form. As far as what they called it, I think theosophy is a word that has been used back in time of the Greeks and Romans. If I'm not sure, I'm not positive, but it's been, this body of knowledge has always been there. Right. It's been expressed by different personalities or different people.
Yes, it has been expressed by great teachers and sages in the past. But theosophy being theosophia or divine knowledge, it's the one true religion in a sense, because it binds everything together. Yes, sir. You had your hand up? Yes.
From a different another point.
Yes, sure.
Okay. In the talk, the idea was brought out that we can look at those who know as the great souls, by various names, mm-hmm. all mind beings. But are they the only monks? Are they the only human beings capable of obtaining true knowledge? Is it possible for us as mind beings to get some idea of what true knowledge is directly?
Well, yeah, we would hope so, that that we can gain direct knowledge, true knowledge. And the masters are the custodians of it, but we may, you know, we may come in contact with a master or an advanced soul and be completely oblivious to it. But the secret doctrine, Isis Unveiled, all of the devotional books that we have, The Voice of the Silence, The Light on the Path, The Light of Asia, The Dhammapada, this is all knowledge that we need to try out for ourselves. If we don't, you know, I mean, you can read a manual to an automobile, but you need to learn how to actually operate it. So this knowledge is out there, but we need to put it into practice, and that's how we learn. We only learn, you know, we can learn from example, we can learn from books, but if we don't, if we just think that that's nice and that's theoretical knowledge, but we don't practice in our daily lives, then we're the same as the worst of, we won't name any religions, but just pick a religion, and many of the followers think that these lofty ideas are wonderful, but that was, you know, but it's just theoretical, and in day-to-day life, it doesn't work. So I can go to church one day a week, or the mosque, or wherever, one day a week. I can pray is all day long, every day, but if I don't actually practice the principles, then I'm a hypocrite. That's there's no other word for it. It's, you know, yes.
I mean, in all the literature that is on the book table and what we study here, there just seems to be one book in particular that actually shows how to tread that path, how to begin and where to go, how to act. And that's the Bhagavad Gita. It embodies that embodies the entire philosophy.
Right.
And it tells us, well, it doesn't tell us. It points out the way of how to act, because we are compelled to act.
Yes, the Bhagavad Gita is the study of adepts. And if we had but one book, that would be the book to choose. Because it's a practical book, it's metaphysical, it's historical, it's, you know, it's all the keys are in there if we look for it. And that's why virtually every summer that's the subject of study, but it's something that we can read a bit of every day and try out. So it's the song Celestial, it's the Krishna is our higher self. Arjuna is our struggling lower self, our personality, who keeps asking for the answer and gets many, many answers, many different ways, many different approaches. But in the end, it's act as seemest best unto thee, because we have to act with the tools that we have and with what's right in front of us. Yes.
Isn't all knowledge true? Or is all knowledge
is
true?
Is all knowledge true? We don't really think so. There's many dogmas that are just terrible, and there are many things in the Bible that are just appalling. And one wonders, you know, how did they slip in there? And, you know, the prophet known as Christ, who came to try to, and just like Buddha came back to reform Buddhism and Christ to reform Judaism, people, you know, they try to hit the reset button, but people still go astray. So these initiates need to come. There's a cycle of initiates. There's a cycle of saviors, as it were. But they're they've already saved their soul. Really, they show us how to save ours. They come from time to time and to show us the way when we've gone too far astray. In the back?
In regards to what is true knowledge, our understanding has always been if it's something that remains true from age to age to age to age, and is for the good of all, not just the individual, that could be an idea of what true knowledge is.
Well, the eternal verities, there are things that are, yes.
Well, true knowledge then is, we heard correctly, is received through the mind, through the faculties of the mind, rather than the senses. Is that
fair? true knowledge is of the mind and not of the senses. I guess it depends on what kind of senses we're talking about. We have higher spiritual senses. And the mind being a principle, the mind can go anywhere it's directed. And with practice, we can use it to gain more knowledge. And we receive thoughts and inspiration from unknown sources, but it's through the mind, but we need to work through the body, we need the vehicle, we need all our senses. We're developing, much of the ocean talks about psychism, because psychism is coming more and more into the fore in our world today. And there are many dangers involved, but it can be used for good. It can be used for obtaining knowledge as well. In the back?
Perhaps if we look at it as knowledge as being the raw product, it's the application of knowledge. Proper application of knowledge becomes wisdom. So all knowledge is just the basic product. How we apply it determines what it is, whether it becomes good or bad or whatever.
Right. it is in its application. And wisdom is spiritual knowledge applied. Yes.
So is knowledge truth then?
Well, that question was asked earlier, and we don't think so. Knowledge in itself, there's all kinds of knowledge. One can know how to make a pipe bomb, and that's fine if we know that knowledge. Should we put it into practice? Would that be wisdom to put it into practice and blow up a building or in the market? We don't think so. That's knowledge as well. It's not, so there's all kinds of knowledge for good or evil.
But that would be a relative truth, a relative knowledge. Aren't there not eternal truths and that are, as was mentioned before, that are never changing? Like, who we are and what's going on here and why this all exists. There has to be a truth behind all of that.
Well, there are truths. So it's, do you want to elaborate a little on that?
Well, you think that in theosophy they're embodied in fundamental ideas, of who we are and from where the universe comes forth.
Right.
As we come forth, and that, karma and reincarnation are just an example of cyclic law, and really the purpose for all of life is a journey back into spirit. So those are eternal truths.
Right. So in the secret doctrine, on page 12 it starts, basically page 12 through 17, and it's many, many other areas throughout the philosophy. The three fundamental propositions of the philosophy are put forth, which are deity, law, and evolution. And this is the basis for all true knowledge that we need. It's right there. Yes.
I guess the big question that was asked by Pilate when Jesus was accused was, what is truth? It's never been answered.
Yes, what is truth? Well, we need to answer that each for ourselves. Nobody can answer that for us, but if it's real, if it seems real, we need to test, check, and verify to find out if it really does work in all situations. And if it does, we may say that that's knowledge. But even the adepts themselves, the masters themselves, they test, check, and verify. And the Oceanus says they have trained psychics among their number. And so they're learning all the time. I mean, they have all the knowledge that we need. They're perfected human beings, but they still grow, they still evolve. It doesn't stop. So they need to, in a sense, test, check, and verify among themselves. Yes.
In a few of the devotional books, it speaks of the importance of humility in acquiring true knowledge and reaching those who know. Why is humility so important? To gain true knowledge, because that would not necessarily be a virtue to gaining knowledge, for example, in college.
Right. College is a place for knowledge, but again, it might not be universal truths. It's relative. There's many relative truths. Education is a wonderful thing. Educare to draw out, because we've all been impressed with these, and we were instructed by great beings in the beginning of the evolution as mind beings, and all the knowledge is really within, but we've covered it up. We've, through our free will and choice, we've made bad choices. So we need to strip away the knowledge that does not serve us. Yes.
Well, back to being humble.
Oh yes, the humility part. Can I just, one second? Yeah, I forgot about the humility part. we know we've all come across people. Some of them could be ourselves, because we are all human. And we just have so much knowledge about some little arcane thing, and we go on and on and on and on, and actually we're really boring people. And we say that a person that talks all the time and monopolizes conversations, we say they're full of themselves. Well, that's not humility, that's the opposite. But if we're full of ourselves, then nothing else can get in. We need to empty ourselves. We need to question everything, all of our assumptions that we've ever been told. And we need to become a vessel that can be, to purify this vessel so that we can start bringing in real spiritual knowledge. Yes.
It reminds us of that statement in the Secret Doctrine, where HPB describes the successive awakenings of the soul, and in each awakening, the soul assumes that it's reached real knowledge.
Yes.
Only to find out that there's more to come. So, of course, humility. If we didn't have humility, or if or let's say we had pride, that would be an obstacle to that successive awakening.
Yes, we can reach many plateaus, but then we see, you know, if we take stock of it, we think, you know, we can maybe take pride. It said that, you know, it said that pride can mark the work. We could reach a certain plateau and then pride kicks in. And, you know, we need to be humbled again before we can realize that, okay, you know, I there's more. I need to seek for more. In the back.
Well, can we say in regards to humility, if somebody's not humble, and as the chair was talking about, somebody so full of themselves, their lower nature then we would think would be in the way of any of this true knowledge, of any kind of higher aspirations, of any kind of spirituality from coming through to be expressed. Whereas if they're humble, they're empty of all that negativity and materialism, so then the higher self has more of a chance to work through that person.
Right, and if we overdevelop our intellects, which many have, then we become, it's like we gravitate, the manas, the mind principle, gravitates downward into matter, into passions and desires, into being acquisitive, into achieving perhaps great heights and perhaps helping humanity. You know, it's don't get me wrong, but that's not spiritual knowledge. Intellectual knowledge is secondary to spiritual knowledge, and spiritual knowledge is of loving deeds the child. It's being humble, it's and loving. You had your hand up.
So it said that compassion is not a virtue.
Right.
It is the law itself.
Compassion,
so,
right, exactly.
So is that a characteristic of being humble, of that knowledge of compassion?
Right, compassion is no virtue. Compassion is no attribute. It is the law of laws. It is really the law. It's to be compassionate is to be at one with your fellow and your fellows. And yes, go ahead.
Is it possible to develop compassion within oneself?
Is it possible to develop compassion within oneself? We would say yes and no. We have to develop compassion within ourselves in order to be compassionate towards others, but some people are merely compassionate towards themselves. And every little thing that happens to them is why me, and poor little old me, Plum for short. And, you know, everything is a catastrophe, and it seems to be more prevalent with those who have more. But so compassion needs to, yeah, in the back.
The idea of developing compassion in oneself is almost an oxymoron.
Yeah. Right.
Because we're always given the command to know thyself. And to know thyself isn't to know the personal self, but the true self of all. So to really develop compassion, you have to have that knowledge of true self of all, a feel for everything, a feel for all
right.
of existence. So that by yourself, you can't develop compassion. It just becomes a selfish, self-interest, like you say, whiny, why me type of thing.
Right, and many, many, that's why these teachings are so necessary. of karma and incarnation, reincarnation, because many think that they can act and there'll be no consequences if they are intelligent enough and crafty enough and wealthy enough. And we don't want to mention any specifics, but there's been something in the news lately about a child that's been sheltered, and they claim that the child didn't know right from wrong because he was never disciplined in any way, got whatever he wanted. But we need to be, that the masters need companions. And to be a companion, we need to feel at one with our fellows. And companion and compassion are related. They're very close to one another. Yes? Yes.
The exact meaning of the word compassion is with feeling. So
right.
If you have compassion for yourself, you're feeling for yourself, going back to being full of yourself.
Yes.
And one way to deal with being full of myself is meditation.
Ah, okay. Yes.
Because in meditation, you can try to empty yourself.
Yes, we need to empty ourselves if we're going to make room for others. Yes.
Before the idea was brought out that of intellectual knowledge and the importance of the intellect, but it would seem that everything we said about true knowledge really requires intuition, and not so much has been said
right.
about intuition.
No, that's true.
Could we have some thoughts on what intuition is, why it's different from intellect, and if it's possible for us to develop intuition, or we just have to?
Okay. Right. That is true. Not much has been said about intuition. It's something that we often hear the term that someone is intuitive. And but there's levels of intuition. To be intuitive, we need to tap into something higher than manas, which is the buddhi aspect, which is our spiritual soul, our higher intellection, our, it's that principle, this which is the storehouse of all knowledge. So if we can access that buddhi, we really can access whatever knowledge we need. And often intuition is something where someone will say they bet on a stock and they'll say that they had intuition. But we need to take stock in our fellows is what we need to do. And that buddhi is, it's the storehouse, it's the font. It's all there, but we cannot really access that higher intuition unless we're working for others. It doesn't work just for ourselves. Yes.
So you're saying then that intuition is a direct perception of what is true?
That's one way it could be said. Intuition is direct perception of what is true. It's a knowing, an absolute knowing. It's not relative knowledge. It's not specialized knowledge. It's universal. And it's for everyone, and we are to share that knowledge if we can. Of course, some people are not ready for it. Some people are not able. You know, their path may be different in this lifetime, but that doesn't mean that they won't find the path, or that they weren't even advanced on the path, but fell from their high estate, as it were. Yes.
Intuition, but now what about our imagination? Because we talk about these masters, well, that certainly spikes our imagination.
It does, yes.
So does this image making faculty that we have, is it important to develop it so that we can gain or we can, I'm not so sure we'd gain, but we would move forward. We can paint a different picture of the world other than what presently exists.
Right. We need our faculties, in Plato's allegory of the cave, he, you know, becomes free of the illusion, but, and then he tries to tell the people that are still mistaking shadows for reality. And that's the way it is with spiritual knowledge. Many of the things that we've been told are shadows of truths, and they cast really a dark shadow in the back.
Yeah, by about intuition. If you develop your sense of dreaming and remembrance of dreams, you can increase your sense of intuition.
So if by working with our dreams, because there are many classes of dreams, but we can learn a lot if we keep a dream journal. Can learn a lot from our dreams. Yes.
It would seem that if we want to develop intuition or direct perception, we have to clear our minds of all our assumptions, all the filters, all the lenses that we normally use, because they would color our intuition. We have to be willing to let go and try to really listen or understand what somebody is saying or what's happening, and not presume anything.
Yes, a real true education is putting aside all one's assumptions and seeing clearly. That's what the true clairvoyance is, seeing clearly into the heart of things rather than through colored lenses. We've got a couple minutes. Yes, go ahead.
So if one has the privilege and opportunity to listen to someone who's a devotee of a specific religion, it's not uncommon that we'll hear them talk about theosophical ideas. They don't call them that way. They may even use the exact same phrases that we've heard expounded from the platform in a lodge. And yet it reaches a certain point where then it sort of drifts off into a particular dogma and ideas. So we have this underlying current of truths, and then we have this fluff that seems to separate us all. Where did all that fluff come from?
Okay. Well, I guess our imagination. We hear, you know, we're all raised in different environments, and most of us, not all of us, but most of us have been raised in some kind of religion. And it's like, it's in the book, and somebody said this or that, or we look for leaders, we look for the answer, for ready-made answers, and that's human nature. It's all that fluff came from, all these accretions came, the further away we are from the teacher, that's why these teachers have to come back from time to time to remind us, because the further we get away from the teacher and the teachings, the more accretions that have come about, and the more, frankly, garbage that there is that's useless. But most of the ideas can be wonderful, theosophical, altruistic ideas, but if we don't realize that we are gods, we are gods, we are potential, we are realizing our potential, and we don't have to look to a teacher and put all our faith in them. We're supposed to be putting these principles in practice. That teacher's already done that. Just like the vicarious, we have to end here, but on this note, vicarious atonement. That's it. That's putting all your faith in this to a Savior, so you don't have to do the work. It's mental laziness is what it is, and it's endemic in society. So we really do. It's really actually after 12. We need to end here. Thank you.